Welcome to the Innovation in Higher Education podcast, where we share the diverse views and perspectives of experts in higher education, innovation, technology, and entrepreneurship from all around the world on topics related to the future of higher education and the future of work in an engaging, fresh, friendly, and very human format. Let's get started.
Welcome to a new episode of the Innovation in Higher Education podcast. My name is Viviana Rojas, and I am the director of Digital Mentor. Today's topic is managing digital transformation in Ukrainian higher education. For this, we are joined by Katerina Suprun, who is the acting head of the expert group on digital transformation of the Ukrainian Ministry of Higher Education and Science. And as well, she's a researcher at Tampere University in Finland at the moment. Welcome, Katerina. So nice to be here with you. Yes, and more so because you're a Marije alumna. So let's say we're from the same family.
Exactly. Marije community grows stronger. Thank you so much for inviting me here.
No, thank you for your time. I would like to start for the first things first, right? Like, how do you start working in digital transformation and the Ministry of Education in your country?
Right. I'd go even further and tell a bit about how I started working in the ministry. So
yes,
we mentioned already that we are all the Marije family. So the Erasmus Mundus Master Joint Program that is called Master of Research and Innovation in Higher Education. And so I graduated from it in 2018 and then immediately came back to Ukraine to work at Ukrainian Ministry of Education and Science. First, I started with the higher education team, working mainly in the areas of higher education financing and international relations. But then 2 years ago, when the COVID was about to hit, I switched to the digital team. And since then, have been working on digital transformation in the area of higher education institutions. And so I have several different directions of my work. This would be the project work, mainly with different IT companies and different services and products that we try to bring closer to people, and different public services and public products that we want people to be able to use in the digital user-friendly format. Mm-hmm. Then we also work with different policies, of course, and draft different legislations and draft laws to make sure that these policies are implemented and are sustainable. And then we also work with partners extensively, especially right now that since last year and the full-scale invasion of Russia and Ukraine started, and we had to secure these additional possibilities for our universities and the whole education sector to go on uninterrupted and to have the possibility to continue teaching and learning.
Great. And so, overall, how long have you been in the ministry?
It's almost 5 years.
Okay. That's already a long path covered. And how, like, from an internal perspective as a higher education professional, especially as a female higher education professional, how has this experience been for you, like, in professional growth?
I think it's an absolutely amazing experience, and I've learned so many things over the course of these 5 years. I mean, coming back from Marije, that already taught me a lot of useful things. It's been the easy onboarding period in a way. Mm-hmm. But then that is the profession that is the public service. And so it's quite specific in this way. And then you have already, since the very start, this macro level, not the institutional perspective, which is on one side more challenging because you have to immediately get full understanding of many different things on this higher level in terms of how you view the system overall. But then on the other side, it provides you, if you're able and willing to take on these challenges onto yourself, many possibilities to develop and to get to meet a lot of interesting people, to learn a lot of different things, and then to be able to develop yourself as a professional in many different areas. So right now I'm working mainly on digital transformation, but then over the course of this several years, I've been able to contribute to other projects as well, ranging from quality assurance to national qualifications framework, then doing extensive work on performance-based funded formula that we launched in Ukraine a couple of years ago, and then doing a lot of different work for Erasmus Plus capacity building projects in Ukraine. So if you are able and willing to look out for new possibilities and new opportunities, then this is the place to start your career, I think, in a good way that provides you a good start and good foundation for anything that you do later in your career. I agree with you. I agree with you, especially, yeah, as a public servant, I think it must be ultra rewarding to, after experiences this 2-year program, and you're meeting people from all around the world and seeing how higher education works all around the world, to take all this knowledge back to your country and make it better there where it's more needed.
I recall one of the first lectures that we had in Mariha program back in the Austrian semester at the Nuke University Krems on systems in transition, where we started the European higher education area in the Bologna process. And so that gave me a lot of useful theoretical background for the work that since then I've been doing in Bologna process on behalf of Ukraine. Mm-hmm. So it's been interesting how the theoretical knowledge that you get in the program gets translated into practice. And it was a useful preparation for the work that I had then to do, I would say.
I agree with you. And one of my main goals was also to go back to Peru and work at the ministry there. But then things happened. I had a child, so I stayed. But, you know, life happens for a reason. So, but that's still definitely in my plans. And right now, as I was mentioning to you before, I am trying to do still, I'm trying to impact my country from where I am, you know, so trying to establish collaboration and cooperation projects between what's happening here in Europe with the Peruvian higher education area. So I guess giving back is also one of the best things and most rewarding things that we as Marihe graduates can hope for.
Yes, and I'm sure you have a good impact on this.
Yes, I mean, I am very privileged and very happy that I can have the privileged position of, you know, bringing all this knowledge and all these opportunities that I find here that we don't know back there, you know. So I think, and I think it's very important, like for every Marihe alumni that would be not only alumni, but current student that would be listening to this podcast, is to think about that. Like, how can you actually, from your experience here, contribute back to your countries and like to really value the connections that you make around here and the opportunities that you are exposed to here that can benefit the reality and the situation of our countries, because many of us come from countries that are still, you know, like in a development state, especially in the higher education area. I mean, it's usually not one of the highest priorities when there are more urgent things. So each of us can make an impact, big impact from where we are.
And Mariha community and Mariha people is the highest value.
Yeah, really. I agree. Okay, so going back to your experience in the ministry, but now especially in the digital transformation group, what would you say have been the highlights of your process there? And we were discussing in the backstage of the interview about partnerships, international collaborations, and some interesting projects that you were working on. So maybe you can brief us about that.
So I would say that there are a couple of different avenues that I consider to be the most crucial for the education sector that we work on together with my colleagues. Since last year and since the full-scale military invasion by Russia in Ukraine, we had to face many challenges as mm-hmm. to how universities operate and as to how, frankly speaking, the whole education sector can continue working and provide the access to learning, teaching, and research possibilities. So I would say that in this respect, one of the main areas that I've been working on with my colleagues would be partnership relations. It's now not a secret that we right now try to collect all the efforts and all the financial resources that we can for our military mm-hmm. in order to win the war as quickly as possible and to liberate all of our temporarily occupied territories back. So you don't really have a lot of financing flowing into education sector. And you have to rely heavily on external partners who are willing to lend a helping hand and to provide the resources oftentimes free of charge or at discounted prices.
I would say it's like a hustle time, right? Like you really have to hustle for it now.
Exactly. You have to really to be good at communicating and mm-hmm. at explaining your needs and providing some solid backgrounds for why you need this help and the services. And so over the last year, a lot of my teammates have been doing this great work with different partners. I've been working mainly with those that provide free of charge services for Ukrainian universities. Mm-hmm. So this would be, not to forget to name anyone, so Coursera, Udemy Analytics, uh-huh. and also Labster, in regard to education content. Mm-hmm. So these would be the top tier education providers, non-formal education providers who have amazing collections of different online contents and courses. And Labster is the company that is relatively new, but it provides really amazing simulation experiences also for schools, but also for universities and colleges. And so we were able to reach agreement with all of them to enable free of charge online courses provision for our Ukrainian students. So what it means in practical terms is that since last spring, I think since March or April, so to speak, these platforms have opened thousands of the really quality courses free of charge. And so any Ukrainian student who would like to take any course from Coursera or from any of these platforms can do so completely free of charge, mm-hmm. and not just to audit the course, but also to receive the certificate of completion that he or she can then use in professional or academic purposes. Mm-hmm. Here, what we did on the side of the minister, for example, also is that we enabled recognition of non-formal and informal education, mm-hmm. For up to 25% for the whole bachelor program. Okay. So let's say if you're a bachelor student, you can basically take one quarter of all your studies from these platforms. And in this way, it's also easier in regard to being able to continue being the student in times of war. Yes. And so this academic content has proven to be very useful. We were very cautious and understanding that we cannot do what we have already done for schools when we talk about universities. So when COVID hit 2 years ago, for example, we have worked with the team to launch the All Ukrainian Online School. So this would be the online platform that provides lessons, video recorded lessons, but also different learning materials for school children from 5th to 11th grade, so middle high school. But then the issue here is that all the school program and all the school curriculum is standardized in a way that it's quite easy to record the videos for school kids, and they can take that all regardless of where you live or which school you go to. Then with higher education, academic autonomy and diversified curriculum and different standards of higher education and different academic offer and learning objectives in each and single course, that would be completely impossible to do. And we thought that instead of trying to come up with the unified curriculum, so to speak, for all the universities, the best thing we can do is to reach out to these amazing partners that we have really, and to ask them for these free of charge offers for our universities. Mm-hmm. And in this way, the professors and the students can come up with their own ideas, which courses they can take on, yes. these platforms to substitute for what they otherwise would have to learn, but cannot do so because maybe the university is destroyed or damaged because, yes. of the Russian missile, or because they cannot go offline. And so instead of doing that, they take some online courses from these platforms.
I was also thinking while you were speaking that this is the unexpected outcome of this is like the improvement of the personalized learning pathways, you know, like, so now, I mean, it's a good thing in bad times, you know, it's kind of an added sweet point, an added value to what normal or traditional education was like, where you had your curriculum established and you had to follow the curriculum that was already existent, but whereas here, actually students have more freedom and flexibility to choose what they really want to learn and more options as well, right? So true. It's kind of
this black swan that comes unexpected that ruins, yes. the whole system, but in a way, instead of just trying to wait until it's over and having massive learning losses, we just tried to come up with the best possible solution that we, yes. could to substitute for it. And I have to admit that online learning is challenging enough. So we have the dedicated team working on deployment of all the solutions at our colleges and universities. And we are working extensively with tech admins at universities to, mm-hmm. Deploy these platforms and to have the highest outreach possible. And then we work with students and then we try to come up with some success stories to motivate and to increase the numbers of students taking use of this learning opportunity. Mm-hmm. But in a way, this is the good chance right now to still mitigate the possible learning losses and yes. to provide some learning offer that is more or less uninterrupted.
Yes, I understand. And have you already gathered feedback from students? How do they feel about this new ways of studying in a way, you know, like they, I guess they were not expecting it from the beginning of their careers. So for the ones that are more advanced, maybe, you know, like how have they reacted to this change?
Well, we do see the numbers of how many students join the platforms, and it's interesting that more and more do join the platforms mm-hmm. And find it useful. And we see the analytical side of what is going on behind these platforms and courses, that students actually are enjoying it. And we see the user dynamics and the user behaviors behind it, which proves that it's a good thing to have anyhow. But we also try to have this regular checks up with universities on how they are doing in general. So with the help of our partners, for example, the World Bank and the UNICEF and the Education Cluster Ukraine, we have already done a couple of surveys of all the universities in the country to see how they are doing in these times, what are the damages, losses with regard to infrastructure, with regard to time of learning, and what are the key areas where universities might need further support from the partners. So I would say that the World Bank team does a lot of work in the area of higher education for Ukraine. That's been the case also before the war started. We've had different partnership arrangements with them. And right now, I would say that they are the key partner when it comes to infrastructure support and mm-hmm. Massive potential further involvement also for our higher education sector. But coming back to another partners mm-hmm. that we had, the online content is really important, but then we also try to come up with some ideas on how we can provide online learning possibilities, mm-hmm. which would be delivered by the teachers at universities, yeah. not by the...
Like online coaching kind of thing?
Yes and no, just typical online lessons.
Okay.
Because right now you cannot do offline learning if you do not have the bomb shelter in
yes.
Ukraine. So that goes for universities, schools, colleges, any kind of education institutions. And so because of that, in some areas that undergo massive shelling and missile attack or are at the borders with Russia and Belarus, for them, it might be better and safer to do the online learning mm-hmm. as in times of COVID, for example. And so for that, you also need to have some additional software and possibilities. Mm-hmm. And here it is Google and Zoom who came to help us.
Okay.
So they have provided free of charge advanced licenses for teaching and learning and also Zoom for education, and made it possible for our universities to continue working in these conditions. And so we have gathered feedback from the technical administrators from universities for these different approaches and different licenses, and they see a lot of added value in it. We are happy to see that, for example, with Google, we also have the continuation of this learning offer. So they have prolonged the time that our universities can take use of this. And we see that it's really helping a lot because if you have the online learning for the third year in a row after 2 years of COVID and now almost 1 year of war, that is not the best thing that can happen to you as a student, especially to those who started during the first year of COVID, mm-hmm. who were the freshmen at the time. That must be a very difficult academic experience, frankly speaking. So we see our task to try to mitigate any risks and any learning losses, and to try to make the study experience as pleasant as possible and as efficient as possible. So that would be what we are doing basically in different dimensions. So for example, UNICEF does a lot of useful work and helps us a lot in school education, but also in broader sense with the so-called MHPSS, which is mental psychosocial support. Mm. And then UNESCO has helped us a lot last year with one very specific and very important task that we have in our enrollment campaign for universities. So what we used to have already for a dozen of years is that we have the paper-based examination that is standardized, unified, and serves as the foundation for entering universities in Ukraine. Mm-hmm. And so people saw great added value in having this entrance examination that is standardized and unified, because it's really leeway from any possible corruption. It is just one and the same exam that everyone takes. The results are weighted. The validity of this test is high, and then it provides this possibility of fair and competitive and transparent access and entry to higher education. Then this examination used to be paper-based, which is not possible to run in times of war, mm-hmm. when you do not really want to gather a lot of people in the same room for prolonged periods of time. So we wanted to keep this examination, and we wanted to let people have this fair entry pass into higher education. So the only possible way to do that would be to make this examination digital in many different areas. But at the end of the day, we understood that we have to come up with our own software fit for the purpose that would be considering many different factors that we have to come up with. And over the course of the 2 months, my colleagues actually made it possible. So we have developed and tested and launched the software for high-stake digital examination for entry into higher education, mm-hmm. with the help of UNICEF as well. And last year, the enrollment campaign took place as normal, as mm-hmm. if the war wasn't there.
Okay.
So all the students were able to take the test, not only those that were in Ukraine, but also those that had to go outside Ukraine in other countries. So overall, I think it's more than 30 countries that run these tests, with several hundred thousand test takers at the end of the day. And it was also very important for us to make sure that regardless if you're in Ukraine or if you're in other country at the moment because of the war, you're still able to take the test and to have this entry ticket in a way to get to Ukrainian university. And so you see that here as well, we know the technology behind it and we are able to set up the processes in this emergency format, but then having this financial support and help from the partners really is something that we cannot go without.
I definitely agree, and I cannot highlight more. I think this is a great example of the importance of establishing a collaboration mindset between all the different actors of society, because when things, unexpected things happen, which have been happening quite often in the past few years, you know, the pandemic, then the war, and now, you know, that we were talking about the aliens that are coming as well to visit us. So, you know, nobody knows what will happen in the future. The future, I think, looks more uncertain than ever now. It's really foggy what's going to happen. So I do think that united we are stronger in a way, you know, and this is mindset work. There needs to be a cultural change, a mindset change towards collaboration, instead of, you know, keeping the things to yourself and just closing yourself to the world and extending Absolutely. Hands. And because, and I think your experience successfully managing digital transformation kind of in an urgent situation, because you were in an urgent situation with not only with COVID, but even more so with the war, and how within your team you could successfully manage to do it and still deliver a quality experience to the students and kind of achieve that higher education keeps working somehow, even though there's a war happening out there. It's one of the best examples that of what the power of collaboration can do, you know. Sure. Yeah, imagine if we would replicate this in all the different aspects of our public services and in general of our lives. Life would be more impactful.
Talking about public services, we've actually embarked on this journey to make them as human-centered yes. and user-friendly as possible even before the war.
Yes.
So we do, because we're a digital team as well,
yes.
So we have this cross-cutting cooperation with Ministry of Digital Transformation in Ukraine that is in charge of all public services for all the sectors. Mm-hmm. And so since years, we've already been doing really useful and interesting projects with them. Mm-hmm. Some of them would include, for example, those that are centered around the digital wallet that we have, and it's mm-hmm. called DIA in Ukrainian. In English, it would be Action. Mm-hmm. So you can imagine this action-driven spirit that the team also has. Mm-hmm. And so the idea behind this wallet is pretty much straightforward, as in many different countries, that you have all your identity documents and different proofs and trackers and, any extracts from public registers in there. So it already has the collection of your internal passport and foreign passport and COVID certificates are there as well.
Okay.
And it's not just the digital collection of your documents, but those are also, they can be shared with any other public authority and they can be verified. So these COVID certificates, for example, that we have there, they can be verified by other countries' border control. So you work a lot of these different interaction and transfer possibilities for these documents. And so a couple of documents that we work on this in regard to education, one is already deployed, another one in the process would be electronic student card that okay. is already available in the digital wallet, and you can use it for any different kind of services that you require in Ukraine. So for example, whenever you travel on trains as a student, you get special discounts for mm-hmm. being a student. And so especially if you're studying in another city, not in your home mm-hmm. city, and if you travel home or if you go around the country very often, then you might end up using this document very frequently. And so it's best to have it in your phone rather than to carry it with you or bring copies. So in this way, it's user-friendly that you have this document at your arm's length whenever you need it. Mm-hmm. And another document that we are working on right now with the team and plan to finalize in a month or so would be the digital diploma.
Okay.
So we have a centralized database with all the education qualifications and all the diplomas awarded to students since 2000s.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
It came in really handy.
A lot of work.
Yeah. It came in really handy during the times of the war, because a lot of those Ukrainian people who went outside the country and had to verify their academic credentials to study somewhere or to find employment somewhere, they could do so easily because the qualifications were recorded in this database.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's personal information, so we take good care of it, not to share it with anyone else, but then you're able to extract information about yourself from this database, for example, and to get it authorized with the technical administrator's signature from the database. And then you just take this extract and then you show this as the proof of your qualifications. But then it takes a little bit of the time and effort on the side of the person. So we saw that we really have to speed up the process of having digital educational documents, digital first, maybe yes. in some time digital only.
Yes.
So what we're working right now with another great partner, who would be the project E4 Digital UA. And so they're run by Estonian e-academy.
Mm-hmm.
Is that we try to make sure that we have this information on academic achievements of a person in the digital wallet. So that would basically mean that whenever you have to get employed, whenever you have to prove that you already finished bachelor to start your master, you can just open the digital wallet on your phone, show the document to the person who has to see it, and then you could share it being the owner of your own data. So this is to be finalized within the next month or so, and then we will also be working with the team to add the information on diploma supplement, which is an indispensable element of educational documents, to the database and to this wallet. And we want to make sure that this service and this feature gets useful for people who are not only in Ukraine but also outside.
Mm-hmm.
So for that, we are working and establishing contacts with the European partners, including the European Commission, to make sure that these documents then comply with all the EU-level regulations and mm-hmm. standards, learning models, and so on and so forth, so that they recognize it and then they don't require any additional bureaucratic documents from Ukrainians who wish to find employment or to study in the EU countries.
Great. Now I am curious about the profiles of your group. Like, what are the different? I imagine it's an interdisciplinary group that you're working in. So can you just brief us a bit from an insider's look about the profiles of professionals you have there in the group?
We are a small team, but
how many?
I think it's around 10 in
Okay.
total, if you count all the people who are within the ministry, but also those that are external hires working with our team. So we have a couple of really, really good lawyers because if you
Very
work with
important
digital,
for data privacy and all this stuff. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yes.
You have to take care of data privacy. You have to take care of all the digital re-engineering that takes place on the level of laws, but also bylaws. And then we have a really good communication officer who takes good stock of all the partnership relations, fundraising, and the work that we've been doing during the last year. I think that's a large share of her efforts and her amazing performance, basically, because she's been able to engage so many new partners and to facilitate really good partnership relations with them. And then we take on from there. And so we have a dedicated team working on school education. It's a couple of people. And then we have a couple of people working on colleges. Then we have me and my colleague who work on higher education institutions. So the colleague is mainly working on deployment of these digital solutions and working with technical administrators of universities. And then we have a couple of people who work on digitalization of science, which is a completely interesting phenomenon to me. But apparently there is a lot to be done, starting from open science and all the way down to how science registers works and how this work is being done on the side of universities, with different journals, indexes, and databases. And then our team lead actually comes from business, which in a way explains why we are maybe so efficient and working outside what is probably considered to be normal in public service.
Yes. I definitely think, and we were discussing this as well in the backstage, like public institutions like need people and professionals that come from outside the public institutions so that they can bring really like new and fresh points of view and ways of working, you know, as well, more agile in a way, because, you know, these are organizations that are very bureaucratic and heavy. And definitely if we want to like advance fast and advance really and measuring as well our advancement and everything, we need different points of view and different backgrounds, I would say.
Absolutely.
For the transformation of the public sector. So yeah, it's the same situation in Peru as well. I think this is a topic for another episode, right? Like how to manage digital transformation, but regarding mindset in public institutions. But okay, now looking into the future, because all of these efforts that you're now doing with your group and from your arena, we'll have significant impacts when the war is over, you know, like, of course, things now it's having an impact, but it will, like, you are basically rapidly building the foundation of, I would say, a digital future for Ukrainian higher education, you know, whether you wanted it or not. It went kind of fast because it was urgent to do so, but, you know, on the bright side of the coin, I would, and the bright side of the, like, of this catastrophe that is, you know, war, we can say that one good output would be like you already have a foundation and like a strong foundation on digital transformation in higher education in Ukraine. So how do you foresee the future now from what you have now in a nice time where the war is over, you know,
right?
Nicer times.
Well, once the war is over, we would anyhow need to come up with reconstruction possibilities and reconstruction efforts. But anyhow, I think that it's maybe a bit more prominent for Ukraine because of the war, but then it's actually the future of the whole world. Mm-hmm. The digital education will, after COVID, play and continue playing a great role in it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's already inevitable. Whether or not you like having lectures in Zoom or whether or not you like doing a large share of your work online, then it's basically the blended learning, in a way, if I may say so, that will be defining the future of education landscape for universities, but also for schools. I would say that in the context of Ukrainian higher education, the key challenge would be is that we have quite a large network of universities. And the problem
How many?
Here, it's around 300, more than 300.
Okay.
And so the problem here lies with the fact that some of them have been already digitally advanced before even the COVID started. So they've already known what is virtual and augmented reality since a decade or so, and they've been having their own studios for course productions, but then others were not so much familiar with it. So I think we will eventually see the situation where some universities are so much driven away with these technological solutions and go forward so fast, whereas others still have to get additional resources and additional support, mm-hmm. which is also an understandable situation. But then after the war is over, we just have to make sure that we have not such a long and big gap in between different universities, and we would need to motivate them to close this digital gap if it is there. We have to take care of digital competences of university staff, because this is something that comes as a key question in many different discussions, also for school sector. You can have the best possible infrastructure, you can have amazing partners who provide you with free of charge
culture licenses. It's strategy for breakfast, they say. Yeah. We say in business.
Exactly. But yes. If you can't use it all, then yes. what's the point of having these resources in exactly. the first place? So making sure that you have regular upgrades of your digital skills, and you know how to use it all, and you're able to supervise your students in case they have challenges in using any of these services or facilities, is key to being able to benefit from the solutions. So we do a lot of work with Minister of Digital and with other partners also on digital competences. Google and other partners are doing amazing training for our teachers and professors on how to use, well, their software and their services in this. So I think that's going to play a huge role. But in general, and when it comes to higher education, so coming back to the first maybe point, the question of academic offer, mm-hmm. which is blended or which is online and which has to be diversified because it's the academic autonomy at the end of the day, is really something that we have to understand how to deal with. Mm-hmm. Because we want to make sure that all the students have, well, the best possible experience that they mm-hmm. can have. And then we want to make sure that students can get to these individual learning pathways. One possibility that we are currently looking into and trying to see how it can play out in the course of several years would be micro-credentials. Uh-huh. That our Ukrainian universities are not yet so much familiar with, perhaps, but then some of them are really willing to take on this role and to try to explore this idea as well. So this is also part of large-scale discussion within the Bologna process for at least the last couple of years. So there are a lot of different working groups and a lot of different projects looking at what micro-credential is, how it can be awarded, how it can be recognized, quality assured, how it can get into being a stackable qualification, whether it is a blockchain or a digital wallet, can still provide the best knowledge and expertise that they have in a way that if student, for example, wants to have a little bit of a different pathway and not getting into the full four-year bachelor program. Mm-hmm. Then on the other side, it also, of course, if to think conceptually, poses some kind of threats to university sector, because so many non-formal providers already have these micro-credential systems at place. Mm-hmm. But then this also comes to the question of how universities can reimagine the role in the future and how to see of themselves not only as the provider of services, but as the entity that provides something that, for example, non-formal courses cannot do you much. And this here we come then really with terms with the fact that digital transformation as the start in this whole process of digital reimagining of universities. But at the end of the day, it has and it can have, and I'm sure it will have this impact more on the system level and more on the conceptual level of how universities can then distinguish themselves from any other forms of education providers, while still keeping up with the pace of how this education market will work.
Okay, I understand. And the question raises in my mind as well as the involvement of industry, right? Like especially when we talk about micro-credentials, I do a direct link with employability, right? So are you also involving industry leaders and industry representatives, especially hiring managers and stuff? And yeah, and these profiles into the design of these micro credentials? Are universities already working with them, or you are taking it from the ministry and then going down? How is it happening?
We do have the National Quality Assurance Agency. And so they have the procedures in place on how you accredit study programs. Those would be traditional study programs, not the micro-credentials, but then the recommendations and the guidelines for accreditation of these study programs do have this idea of having the employment sector and the work market representatives involved. So we as the ministry do not have any say with regard to academic programs. All we set as the rules of the game would be the National Qualifications Framework, which is a very high-level document in a way. And then we have the standards on higher education field-wise. So, for example, we would have one standard for medicine and another one for pedagogy, which is obvious in a way. And you see the set of learning objectives that students have to achieve within the frame of these fields of study. So for example, if you study medicine, you have to be able to, well, have conceptual knowledge on this and skills on that. But other than that, when it comes to designing study offer and study programs, it's the responsibility of the universities on how they do this, as long as they are able to meet these learning objectives and to comply what they do with the National Qualifications Framework. And then I know that a lot of universities, especially those that are in more practically oriented field, mm-hmm. they have quite a good involvement of the industry. Mm-hmm. It probably can be better, mm-hmm. But this is something that they take care about. And I think it's, what is important in this respect would be the feedback from students. Mm-hmm. So I see over the course of the last years how student feedback channels get better developed in Ukraine. We do have student representatives involved in the accreditation processes, so both external and internal quality assurance for something. And if you try to clearly outline what is not so working well and what the possibilities for improvement are, then this is again another voice and another, well, possibility to get more practical involvement and to get industry being more involved. We do have a very interesting, I think, learning format, which is dual education. Mm-hmm. It's practiced mainly at the level of colleges, but still which are part of tertiary education, and at the level of some universities that work mainly with practical fields. So the idea behind this dual education is that you dedicate 50% of your time to study and then 50% goes into apprenticeship, so to speak. And in this way, you come out of your studies better prepared for the job market, having already some quite extensive practical involvement with the industry, and also possibly having a prospective job place after you graduate. So this is something that is great for this reason.
I always say, I mean, back in Peru, when I was working in universities as well, I always try to make, to close the loop, you know, the loop of value for a student at the end. Maybe, of course, the outcomes and the goals of education, higher education will vary, will vary from country to country. But at least in Latin America, one of the main outcomes that students are looking for is job placement, like entering the job market. They're not looking to be researchers. They're not looking to have an academic career. This is not the case. They want to get into the companies, you know, and high quality companies. And universities often don't address this need. So definitely it's about creating a program that closes the loop value and not only provides training, but also the connections, the network, the experience, and at the end, so that at the end, the student can get the expected outcome that they want. You know?
So, but then again, if we come to the topic of what the universities are there for, if we are talking about them as the providers of future employment in a way or facilitators of those, then this is totally fine with me and it's a valid point. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, we see, especially with IT disciplines, that mm-hmm. it costs less and it takes less time to get into any kind of non-formal IT school.
Exactly. And you can learn the
less
skills.
Time, yeah. Spend less money, pass examination and be employed in a year or in 2 years at this same company. Whereas for university, you would have to go through, well, 4 years of bachelor studies, for example.
And I
then,
agree.
Well, 1 or 2 years of master's. So the question comes then, what is this added value of university? And I think this is something that, well, ministries and policymakers and practitioners, and
they're breaking their heads
have to answer, because they have to bring added value, and they have to, well, I think the discussions that go on in recent years about the social dimension of universities is something really important, because as we see, then universities do not really have to stay within themselves as closed systems, but they have to interact with the industry. Yes. They also have to interact with wider society
and the government. The needs are. And,
like, exactly.
But not only for funding, because I mean, this is also, we are drifting a bit on the topic, but it's, I think it comes naturally when we talk about digital transformation, because digital transformation is not only about technology, it's more, even more so about mindset. And I would say that, I mean, now in a digital world where universities are struggling to find their, what is the difference, like the value that differentiates us, and why would a student come to us, you know, to study, when actually there are easier ways and faster ways to get into what they want. It's to reimagine what universities can do, not only as learning providers or trainers, but as well as creators of change. You know, I think the part of technology transfer enters to play here a bigger role. And and we will see how can actually technology and knowledge that can be that can start at a university, at research centers, that actually, for this, I would say universities have an added value, because you create a territory, you create people that are able to create something else, not only to work or to do like tasks, but to create and to manage things into a bigger and systemic approach. But how can you actually bring this from the minds and the papers and all the, you know, everything that goes to ResearchGate? How can you actually apply it?
Exactly. Right.
So there's so much information there that has to be, that can be applied. And I cry every time I see that, researchers and academics are spending 3 years, you know, doing their PhDs to at the end have a dissertation and just put it in, you know, like ResearchGate. And that was it.
Could be useful as well, but depends on the kind of personality goals that you set in front of you. But what I wanted to add also on top of that, you're absolutely right in the fact that you have to understand what co-creation value you bring in, because with ChatGPT coming in, is broad the picture, and with their artificial intelligence solutions, you cannot really rely any longer on being able to reproduce the text and be successful, because you're able to do so very well.
I love ChatGPT, by the way.
Here.
I think it's a great assistant.
You do have to figure out your added value to the university ecosystem. And for example, talking about this additional added value and social responsibility, well, I think that in this current situation that we are living through of Russian invasion to Ukraine, then those, for example, companies that we are working with, they have really demonstrated not only they understand the context and which side evil or the right they are picking, but also the corporate responsibility and the social responsibility, because they providing us so much time and effort and resources totally free of charge. And this is part of this corporate mission that they have. So in a way that this resonates as well with universities' CERT mission and this social responsibility that they are bringing, because at the end of the day, it's the question of what your fundamental values are, what you believe to be true, and what you would like to contribute to, regardless if it brings you profit or not.
Yes, I am 100% with you. Well, Katarina, it has been really nice talking to you. I think it's time for us to close the interview. I don't know if you have any parting words for the audience listening.
Thank you so much, Viviana, for inviting me, first of all, and I hope this discussion was useful for the listeners. If you're interested to, well, follow up the work I'm doing, whether at Tampere University as a researcher, or the work that our team is doing at the ministry, feel free to follow me on social media. I am on Twitter and LinkedIn, more frequent visitor at LinkedIn, so just send the request or follow or send a message, and I would be very happy to get in touch. So the topics that I'm currently most engaged with, apart from the digital transformation and the different projects and initiatives there, would also be the performance-based systems and funding. So if you have the interest to work in this direction, feel free to send a message.
Great, Katarina. So, okay. I'm sure we will have you again on the podcast because we have a lot of things to discuss, and it's always nice to share ideas with not only with Marihe minds, but with bright minds as well in general. So I guess this is all for now, and keep in touch for the next episodes of the high, no, what's the name of my podcast? And keep in touch for the next episode of the Innovation in Higher Education podcast. Bye.
Thank you for listening to the Innovation in Higher Education podcast. Follow us on LinkedIn and subscribe to our newsletter to not miss any episode. You can also find us on Instagram and TikTok as @innovationinhighered. Cheers!